etymology, which no one can spell, and no one really knows what it is, except Valerie. And that's because she's a philosopher on top of being a lot of other things. Valerie has a very conventional beginning. How's that, Valerie?
That's
true. She was a physical education type, very early.
I'm not surprised.
No, that's surprised. She broke out of time. And as she moved along, she got more and more interested in all kinds of fascinating bypaths, and she's become the mascot of our movement because she's been doing the most significant research around structural integration problems. I'm not going to put many more words in your mouth except to say that it's very exciting to me that she agreed to be the coordinator of this theory. And in a minute, she'll have a chance to introduce our speaker. And I hope you won't put the kind of words in his mouth.
You see, the reason he did this is because this course was actually born over tea. When I and Rolf got our hands off of me before they put them on him. And that's when the course was born.
We share something. Apparently hands. Now, I just have a couple of brief things I want to say, and then I'll go away. They are these. I have to repeat to you that there are no single admissions for the class. This is not a lecture series. This is a class. So tell your friends, and please remind them not to come and stand at the door looking painful, because there's nothing I can do about it. If it had been set up as a lecture series, you would have done it. It was. It was set up so that I would have an honest-to-God university class. It's very easy to get a big crowd with a loud microphone, but to get people who stick with you around a subject of study over a long period of time is more difficult. I wanted to demonstrate to her that there were people who cared enough about the concepts around which this was built, who would come back, who would invest some time and some depth in going with her and some of her ideas. And that's much more important to me than lots of people coming in on single admission. Next time we may do it on the other basis. So, at any rate, you're in the verdict of the nation. For those of you who are taking the course for credit, and you'll be interested to learn that there are many taking the course for university credit, I will do the sheet next time. If the plane gets in even earlier, at least we've made our agreements about what needs to be done, and I will duplicate that and get it to you. Let me see if there's anything else. Next time, we will go back across the green, and all the rest of the classes will meet in the great room, pink walls, green seats, yellow, you know, the whole thing. For Werner tonight, got the leftovers because we had some trouble across the way. We were thrown out for the evening, but I know you will overcome it, Werner, right?
We'll do our best.
Fine. Now, go, girl.
Thank you. If there are two coordinators stay off of the airplanes, I think maybe we'll get this thing going. I have only one other thing to add to what Bob said. See, I'm supposed to be a coordinator, and I don't know what I'm coordinating. But if you have any individual questions about registration, see me afterwards. I'm requesting no smoking in during our lecture period. I'm a pipe smoker, and I'm not going to smoke for this time. Well, we've got a real rare treat for us tonight, an exceptional treat, and I'm not going to take long, except to just remind you, as I met Werner tonight, I said it is not possible for him to look like this, to be this age, and to have done all of these things. That's an impossibility. But just to say to you that if this course were opened up now for individual basis, this man would fill three auditoriums like this just by hearsay. And he established the famous EST educational organization, which really is not very old. I understand in 1971. And there have been 26,000 people who have, in all walks of life since that period of time, who have been trained through this educational organization, located in five places in this country, headquarters in San Francisco, an office here in Los Angeles, And their purpose is to open additional dimensions for life experiences. And this, in short, is like raising levels of awareness, expanding consciousness, and that's an awful lot of people who have been trained. In addition to this, he studied, experienced, and practiced. And I think those three things, a lot of us study it, don't practice it, we're doing experiences. The Eastern and Western philosophies, including Zen, the martial arts of Aikido, and Tai Chi. I understand he's worked in Scientology, Gestalt therapy, and the master, Tyler Rolfe, has had her hands on him too. We share those things in common. In addition to this, I was told that he's held over 36,000 individual hours of consultation. And that's an awful lot of hours. He's been associated with the outstanding people, or the people who are the most influential thinkers in the world today, having to do with conceptual frontiers of human understanding. He is associated with them, and he has influenced them. And that is a really rather profound thing to recognize. He's a dynamic and a challenging person, and who could be better to talk to us tonight about the mind than our speaker, and it gives me extreme pleasure to introduce to you Werner Schulze.
Thank you, great pleasure. Glad I don't have to live up to that. It was very kind of Dr. Hunt to introduce me in that way. Actually, I've heard a great deal about her and from Ida, and since hearing about her from Ida, I've heard about her from other people. And she's, as I told her when I walked in, her reputation precedes her by a long way. I also have a reputation, but it means something different when you say I have a reputation than when you say that Dr. Hunt has a reputation. And I'm interested, whoever chose me to speak about the mind, because my work is blowing people's minds, and I don't know why I would be considered as qualified to speak about the mind, but in blowing some minds, I've discovered
a couple of things I'd like to share with you. I'd like to share them with you from a
particular point of view. I'd like to share them with you from the point of view of structural integration. Rather than to talk about what I've observed from any other point of view or even my own point of view, I'd like to relate it to my experience of structural integration and what I've understood from what Dr. Rolfe has said and what you shared with me. I think that the first thing that's really important when you talk about the mind is to recognize that it's that you've chosen an impossible task for yourself. Because it's kind of a waste of time to talk to people about their minds. Because the problem is that people listen to information about their minds with their minds. And so what they do is to get some more information that they didn't have before. And if you keep accumulating information, what happens is that you get a lot of information. And that's all right if what you're out to do is get a lot of information. And information can be important and useful, but it kind of isn't my bag. My bag is to kind of destroy information. And I think you'll see what I mean by that as I go along. At any rate, I understand that Dr. Bach will be here to speak about the spirit, and that someone else will speak about man. And I think Dr. Hunter will speak about the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I just want to before I begin to speak about the mind, to kind of put it in context. I just spoke about the open universe and the closed universe, and for me, the mind is the closed universe. She spoke about the closed universe being linear and measured, and she used a very good analogy, for me at least, and that is that we attempt to understand what's going on by putting a grid of straight lines over it. And we assign numbers to the squares in the grid. We can define what it is we're looking at by a set of numbers, coordinates in that way. And we say, well, I know about that then, because I've measured it. That for me is what the mind does. It knows about things. And so you and I have the sense that we know about things which perhaps we don't know about. We don't know about them because to know means something more than to put a grid over them and to assign a set of coordinates to them. And that's essentially what the mind does, as I'll demonstrate or as I'll explain later on. That's my view of what the mind does, as I'll explain later on. The point that I want to underline regarding putting this business about the mind in context is that it's very clear to me, based on my own personal experiences, that you and I are not our mind. And historically, that's kind of always kind of gotten interwoven. It was interesting, I came down with a gentleman, and on the way over here, he said that Milton had said that the mind is a place of its own, and that it makes it by itself can make a heaven or hell. And that's a kind of statement that comes from the notion that either I am my mind, or if I'm not, it's running me. I mean, I'm dangling on the end of its string. And that's kind of been man's viewpoint. And so he's learned about his mind, thinking that he is his mind. And the mind, as I see it, is a representation of a person. It isn't the person. It's kind of, as Dr. Rolfe said in her introductory remarks, I guess it was last week, it's the map and not the territory. And if you think that the map's the territory, you get in very big trouble. Because if you walk across a piece of paper, you don't know what mountains are like. Even though you walk across a piece of paper that is a map of the mountains, you don't know what mountains are like. I don't know what mountains are like. So I see the mind as a part of the whole. I see whatever it is, I don't know what to call us, but whatever we are, I see us as the open universe and the mind as a part of that, or the closed universe. And the damage that I see that gets done is that people attempt to function in this closed universe and define the open universe. And the problem with defining the open universe from inside the closed universe is that you deal with it conceptually only. You don't deal with it directly. You make models of it because modeling is the way you deal with things which are bigger than you. And so what I'd like to do now is to get off that, talk about my notion about what the mind is, and then perhaps come back and see how it fits into the whole of whatever it is that you and I are. I have a really... Is there a way to pull this out to the center diagram?
Sure.
I have a really very mundane practical notion about almost everything. I didn't plan it that way. It's just the limits of my capacity, I guess. And my notions about the mind are very mundane and very practical. Fundamentally, I see that what the mind is a set of records. And so what the mind is records. Now, records are take many forms. You know, a phonograph record that has a music or voice on it, or you can have a file folder with a bunch of information in it, or you can have a videotape, or you can have a novel, or the list is almost endless. There are lots of different kinds of records, and what the mind is records. And the mind is a record of particular things, of a particular thing. And what the mind is a record of now. So, if you will, let me represent now by this point. And if we can define this point as an instant of now experience, or let's make it simpler, just an instant of now. And if we can use this line over here to be the edge of something that might look like that, for instance, like a photograph, then this would be the record of that. Now, it's a kind of interesting thing. I would tell you first off, right off the bat, that almost immediately, if I ask you to tell me what's happening right now, you will tell me what's happening here. For instance, if I ask you to tell me what's happening to you right now, just tell me anything that's happening to you right now. What's your name?
Joe.
Joe, could you tell me something that's happening to you right now?
My ear is itching.
Good. Now, Joe said, my ear is itching. And what he was describing is what happened to him a moment ago. He didn't describe what was happening to him now. As a matter of fact, if you attempt to describe what's happening to you now, you'll find out you can't do it. Because as soon as you open your mouth, you'll be talking about the past. In other words, you are no longer talking about the instant of now, you're talking about the record of the instant of now. Consequently, I'd like that to kind of illustrate to you and make clear to you that human beings, for the most part, have got to be stuck in their minds. Because we short flap our yaps a lot. And when I'm flapping my yap, I'm stuck in my mind. For sure. So at any rate, what the mind is not an instant of now, but a record of an instant of now. And it's a particular kind of record. It's a multi-sensory record. And I mean multi-sensory in a broader way than the way in which you think I mean. I do mean the traditional five senses and the kinesthetic sense and all those other breakdowns of physical senses that Dr. Hunt will, I'm sure, tell you about when you get to man, yes? Mention those
things. I may not.
May not, okay. Well, you'll have to read the book because I'm not sure what the breakdowns are. At any rate, when I say multi-sensory, I mean something beyond the traditional notion of senses. I, for instance, mean that that moment, that that record of right now includes in it every sensation in your body, even those sensations which were peripheral to your consciousness. All the sensations of your body are recorded in that record of that moment of now. In addition to which, your feelings are recorded in there, a record of how you felt. See,
my answer is Lloyd.
Lloyd? If I ask Lloyd how he feels, he can tell me. Well, he isn't actually telling me how he feels, is he? He's telling me how he felt a moment ago. And he's able to tell me how he felt a moment ago because the record includes his feelings. See, he feels now and makes a record of the feeling, and then he can describe the record. I mean, if he asked me, for instance, Werner, what's your attitude? I could tell Roy my attitude because in this multi-sensory record is a record of attitude. And in that multi-sensory record is a record of all which is. Okay? If it is, it's in there. Now, in the normal course of events, this talk takes me about 8 hours, and I'm going to do it in an hour. So when I get to the hard parts, I'm going to gloss over it quickly.
Okay.
Yes. The hard part is that I mean multi-sensory in an even bigger way than I've said so far. For instance, I mean that Lloyd's record of right now includes not only his emotional state, but a record of my emotional state. It isn't commonly accepted that you and I have the ability to perceive emotions directly. We would say Lloyd could figure out Werner's emotional state by clues. I'm saying something more than that. I'm saying that this record of right now includes a direct perception of my emotional state. I'm saying that you and I have the ability to sense each other's, to sense, in terrible words, to something each other's emotional state, and to do it directly. And that the mind will make a record of that perception, if I can use it, the wrong word. Close up. The record is so multi-sensory that it's even more multi-sensory than that. But that's enough for tonight. When I do the 8-hour version, I'll tell you this. I'll get the rest of it in there. So, what the mind is then, is a multi-sensory record of a moment of now. I want to expand the definition. The mind is a multisensory record of a moment of now, and it's also a total multisensory record of a moment of now. In other words, it includes all those things which you were aware of now, all of those things which you were not aware of now. For instance, in my periphery is Don, and there he is. You know, he's full blown over there. And while I'm paying attention to, and I know you, I don't know your name.
Jim.
If I'm paying attention to Jim, I don't see Don, but I do see Don. And we all know that the literature supports the fact that the records held in the brain, and I'm not talking about brains, I'm not talking about minds, that the records are really kind of total. And that they are so total that they contain the minutest details. In other words, when in brain surgery, when people's brain cells are probed, people don't remember, they relive. In order to relive an experience, that experience has to be recorded in incredible detail. I mean, imagine the incredible detail with which it must be recorded. So when I tell you that the record is multisensory and total, it isn't really very difficult to accept that if you take a look at some of the evidence we have. Now, I mean actually more total than you think I mean, but we won't get into that either. Tonight, please don't get into that. I mean total, total. But, like I said, that's upsetting, so we won't get into that. We're going to stay conservative here and talk about the normal kind of total. The point is that the record includes a hell of a lot more than you thought it did. Than we normally think it does. You and I know each other, so that's Phil, thank you. I remember Phil when I looked at him. He and I have shared some experiences together. And one of the things that wasn't there for me was his name. But his name is in that record. So there's a whole lot of other information. Now I act with him as if I am limited in my interaction with him to the material that's available to me. I pretend that's so. Now those of us who have studied a little psychology or a little psychiatry knows that the material which isn't available to me is perhaps playing a greater role than I'm normally aware of. But I only remember that every once in a while. In the normal course of events, I act like, well, it's just what comes up for me. It's just that part that I can remember. Okay, so at any rate, what the mind is a multi-sensory total record of a moment of now. Now the mind, and this, if it has any importance, will have to come up later, just plain ordinary fact at the moment. The mind stacks these records linearly, one after the other, like so. So that the mind then is a linear arrangement of multisensory total records of successive moments of now. There are successive moments of now, and these are records. And so that's the first and most fundamental notion, or first and most fundamental observation that I've made about my mind and about your mind, is that what the mind is a linear arrangement, multisensory, total records of successive moments of now. And that the totality of the record includes the metabolism of every cell in that moment, the function of the endocrine system, the degree of contraction in any muscle cell, and the state of each cell in the body. So the record is really total, or multi-sensory, or very multi-sensory. That's not very popular to say that, by the way, because it's not wonderful, you know. It isn't terrific. It isn't poetic. It isn't wild. It isn't, you know, it stinks. And it's too bad. It's the way I have it, you know. So there it is. That's what the mind is. It's a linear arrangement of multi-sensory total records of successive moments of now. Then the next question, that's what the mind is. See, had you asked me, Werner, what is the mind, that's what I would have told you. Now I'd be finished answering that question. And then you might ask me another question. You might say, what is the purpose of the mind? In other words, why have those records? And then I have an answer to that, which I'm going to lay on you next. The purpose of the records is very simple. A lot of people think that the purpose of their mind is beauty. People think that the purpose of their mind is aliveness. People think that the purpose of their mind is discovery. People think that the purpose of their mind is love. People have thought the purpose of their mind is an incredible array of things, all of which bring us to a state in which we can't explain our behavior, or if we can explain it, we can't explain it in a way that we can do anything about it. See, I have a little problem with most of what I know. Most of, about 99.9% of what I know, we all know. I have a problem with it. My problem with it is that it hasn't produced anything of any value humanly. It's produced caves for people to live in with square walls, which are obviously much better than round walls. And also it's produced a level of sanitation which now allows us to go to the bathroom in our own homes. Because, you know, back when they didn't have good back when sanitation wasn't so good, you had to go outside to go to the bathroom. Now you go to the bathroom in your house. So whatever I know has produced a degree of material well-being which is incredible. I mean, it's so good that you can go to the bathroom in your own house. Normally not too far away from the kitchen because of the way plumbing is. The point is that the quality of our lives is perhaps not any different than the quality of people's lives 10 years ago. Now, in the last 10 years, an incredible number of things have been discovered, and the quality of my life hasn't changed at all in 10 years. And if I go back 1,000 years, it's just about the same as it was 1,000 years ago. You know, there are a certain number of people who are all right, a certain percentage of people who are not all right, a certain percentage of people in the middle, and the same kind of problems that people had in families 1,000 years ago they have today. And I have not seen that the quality of life has changed at all. You know, we've gotten very arrogant about our ability to communicate. I can remember when I was a youngster, people said, boy, television, now we're having an informed electorate, and people will be able to elect really superior government people. And you know how that's worked out. You see, it may not be that this plethora of words is communication. In other words, communication may be something that happens in a very different place than the place in which we've always thought it happened. You know, we think that if we say more, we'll have more. But there's no evidence to that. There's no evidence that that the quality of our lives is any better than the quality of people's lives 10 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Just not much evidence. So the notions about the purpose of the mind seem to me to be inadequate in that they don't work. Now that's incredibly arrogant. It's too bad. It's the way I see it. And if it's arrogant, then I will be arrogant. My observation of the purpose of the mind is that the mind has a single purpose and it has no other purpose but that single purpose. And the single purpose of the mind is survival. By the way, I have no respect for people who can only spell a word one way. I'd like to tell you that I chose that word specifically and particularly because it's the only word which I consider to be accurate. So that means that if it reminds you of another word, I don't mean that. I mean that word, and I don't mean any other word. I mean that word and that word alone. And I mean the sense that that word evokes, and I mean the particular definition which that word evokes. And I'd like to tell you that, as I observe it, the mind has no purpose other than survival. It doesn't have a third purpose or a 49th purpose. Its first, second, third, and all purposes are survival. And the purpose of the mind is the survival of the being. The mind's purpose is the survival of the being. Now, I haven't defined the being, and I'm not going to define the being because that's going to be handled in another night. See how we got past that quickly, you see.
I'll let Dr. Bach do that one.
At any rate, the purpose of the mind is the survival of the being, and here's the hook, or anything the being considers itself to be. So, let this shape represent a mind. I'll put an M in there so you won't forget it. Let this shape represent a being. I'll put a B in there so that you won't forget. And let this shape represent a thing, and I'll put a T in there so you won't forget. The purpose of the mind is the survival of the being, or anything the being considers itself to be. So if this being considered itself to be this thing, the purpose of this mind would be the survival of this thing.
Let's say it one more time.
The purpose of the mind is the survival of the being, or anything the being considers itself to be. Now, I haven't told you how the mind works yet, or what it does to bring about this purpose. Just what it is, and what its purpose is. Now, I'd like to tell you something which I consider to be one of the most important things I know. Now, I only know three important things, so you're going to get one-third of all of it tonight. In fact, I'll tell you two-thirds of it. The first thing I know is that nothing is important. That's one-third of what I know. Second third of what I know is what an ego is. And I'm really pleased at having discovered what an ego is, because it suddenly illuminated all of the things that ever we studied from the Eastern philosophies and Eastern disciplines. And it made a hell of a lot of sense out of the Western psychological and psychiatric notions and a lot of the philosophical notions. Because a lot of what people say about ego is very accurate. But nobody ever says what it is. So I'd like to tell you exactly what it is.